Welcome, everybody, to the Third and Gold podcast presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Tyler James, and I'm joined, as always, by the one and only Eric Hansen. Together, we cover Notre Dame football, recruiting, and more for BlueandGold.com on the On3 Network. Notre Dame left Massachusetts with a 25-10 win over Boston College, but it came back to South Bend with even more questions about the kicking game ahead of Saturday's matchup with Navy. Because the kicking discussion is so prevalent this week, Eric and I figured we'd reach out to someone who knows quite a bit more about kicking than we do, and we're fortunate enough to have former Notre Dame kicker Mitch Jeter with us today. Mitch, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me.
Mitch, just to start, what has been your experience of watching Notre Dame this season?
I pretty much have tuned into every single game this year, just because I know a lot of the players that are still there. And obviously, you know, I only had a season there with the Irish, but it was a special season for sure. And, you know, glad the boys are rolling right now.
Mitch, do you know, you would know Marcello, but do you know Eric Schmidt or Noah at all?
Yes. I mean, obviously I played with Marcello. Noah and I actually are from both from North Carolina, so we grew up in the same kind of kicking area. So I knew him growing up. And then Eric, I guess he was around sometimes when I was playing as he was getting recruited, but, you know, not necessarily on a personal level. I know Noah a little better.
And do you guys communicate at all? I mean, do you ever reach out to each other, you and Noah especially?
You know, I've been in touch with Noah, you know, more so at the beginning of the season and throughout the summer a little bit, but not necessarily, you know, as the season has gone on, just because, you know, I know how it is to be a college football player and have the bullets flying at you all the time. So kind of let the guys do their thing. You know, I'm still in touch with a few guys on staff or, you know, on the team a little bit there, but not necessarily recently now.
I'm curious, when you're a kicker and you miss some kicks, do you feel like everyone is reaching out to you to try to support you? Does it get overwhelming at some point? It's like, hey, just leave me alone. I'm going to figure this out.
Yes and no. I mean, sure. Like it's not fun to go out and miss kicks, but it's not necessarily anything that you should treat differently. You know, whether you make or miss a kick, in my opinion, I always tried to treat every single kick the same way of when I would go out to try to execute a field goal. My mindset was similar if I made the kick or I missed the kick previously. So I tried to have a similar mindset, and I'm sure that every other kicker is very similar in that state as well.
Mitch, can you take us through what happened with you last year, how the injury started, how you got past the physical part of that, and how you got past the mental hurdles, I guess, that comes with being injured?
Yeah. You know, obviously starting the season at Texas A&M last year, being able to start really hot and having a little bit of issues with the NIU game, and kind of other than that, like felt like I was in a great spot of kicking how I normally do. And as I went throughout the season, I was doing both kickoffs and field goals. And honestly, just think I had a little bit of wear and tear on my body. And, you know, I was kicking off in I believe it was the first kickoff of the Stanford game where I actually kicked a football. And when you kicked a football, a lot of impact is taken onto your groin, your hip, your quad. And like something in my hip popped, right? So I tore something in my groin. Ended up having some swelling, some bleeding, kind of my groin area. My leg was black and blue for like the next Wow. 3 weeks. So that was kind of what was going on there. It wasn't just like, hey, this guy, you know, he just doesn't have it anymore. Like I physically, my leg was very in shambles. Right. But to be able to kind of bounce back, get that leg healthy, and then be able to come back in the playoff and hit some big kicks down the stretch was a lot of fun. But, you know, your mindset is, you know, obviously there's a comfort factor there, right? Of when I'm kicking the ball, am I in pain? And if the answer is yes, you know, that's going to affect your mindset a little bit. If the answer is no, then it's like, all right, I'm back to myself. I can kick normally and not have to worry about physical factors.
And who helped you through that mindset? Was it your family? Was it yourself? Did Marty or, you know, people on staff at Notre Dame help you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of credit to obviously my family. You know, I'm, as any college football player or any person, you talk to your family a lot. So that was big for me. And then obviously being able to communicate with Coach Freeman, Coach Biagi, Coach Schmidt on staff there, Coach Freeman being the head coach, obviously, and then the two special teams guys I met with all the time. And then I would be in communication with a sports psychologist, which was pretty standard for all the specialists there. We'd always meet with a sports psychologist, whether that's one-on-one or as a group. So I was able to kind of meet with them as well and just kind of, you know, either that's talking things out, you know, visualizing, if we're in a different stadium, we do some things like that, but not necessarily anything else.
That's cool.
Mitch, as you made that return last season from the injury, when did you feel right? When did it, or if did you ever feel right? Did it take till the off season to sort of get back to 100%?
No, I mean, I probably, you know, obviously injured it in the Stanford game, sat the Georgia Tech and Navy game, and I felt it in my leg kicking for probably the next four games of whatever that was. I don't even know. Florida State, Virginia, Army,
USC, so the regular season, yeah, right.
So USC, that was probably like the last time I was like getting pretty close to be feeling really good. And then we had a couple weeks off before the playoff. And then once we got back to Indiana, that kind of game, I was like, all right, I can kick and feel normal. And then, you know, really when I felt my best back to 100% was when I was kicking off again, which would have been the Georgia game. Cause I was like, all right, I'm back to the Mitch Jeter that I know, and I can do both jobs at an elite level. So that's when I felt the best.
And what is the challenge of preparing yourself for games when maybe you're not feeling 100% yourself? How do you balance getting the work in? Because you got to do some of the work to prepare, but also not harming yourself or making yourself more or dealing with more pain.
You know, I relate a lot of kicking to a golfer's mindset. You know, whether a golfer has a tweak in whatever back neck, you know, they're not going out to the range and beating balls trying to get better, right? Like they're being smart about how many balls they're hitting. That's kind of what I was doing, is being smart about how many kicks I would kick in practice, the amount, the rep count that I had, to still get quality work, but not be over kicking in a sense.
And so you felt like yourself against Georgia. You must have felt superhuman against Penn State. That kick still gives me goosebumps when I watch it going through the uprights, and then they show your family in the stands going nuts. And, can you take us through your mindset going into that kick and how it felt afterwards?
Yeah, honestly, you know, not a lot of people think about this, but I talk with the specialist on that unit a lot, myself, Reno Monteforte, and Chris Salerno, the snapper and holder. And, you know, we all are pretty much in agreement that we felt like the harder kick was the extra point beforehand. It was after, I think, Gray House's touchdown, and it was 23-24, and, you know, whatever, there's probably 4 minutes left in the game, and, you know, we got to go out and make an extra point, tie the game, right? So that was probably a more stressful kick. But then when you're tied 24-24, going down the final stretch to hit a game winner to go to the national championship, obviously the headlines with that are, you know, something that it creates a lot of pressure. But you know, our mindset was just, hey, we're going to go out and try to execute. And we've been in pressure situations the whole playoff, the whole season, when our backs have been against the wall. So, you know, we felt very confident we could go out there and execute.
Mitch, the pressure aspect of that, there's only so much that you can sort of replicate in a practice setting. What did you find was the best way to sort of get yourself, I don't know, as nervous as possible or feeling as much pressure as possible in a practice setting?
You know, I really think Coach Freeman and Coach Biagi did a great job of putting pressure on myself and the other specialists of, you know, where that's just in periods of just being around the coaches, because those are the guys you're trying to impress, right? Like when it's game day, the coaches are on your side, right? The coaches, you know, might be creating a factor in practice to try to mess with you, where on game day, they're all behind you. So not necessarily, I didn't, you know, there is a different sense of practice to game of, you know, kicking in front of 100,000 people. You can't really replicate that. But being in practice, trying to impress the guys that ultimately are holding the keys to your job was enough stress in itself.
So when there are kicking problems on a team, especially if it's Notre Dame's team, the fan solution is go fish somebody off the soccer team because Brandon Aubrey was a soccer player at Notre Dame and they don't know that there was a long gap before he became a pro kicker. But you were a really good high school soccer player. So off of everybody on your high school soccer team, how many do you think could actually become a college kicker with very little training?
It is, you know, sure, it's an easy comparison because you both kick a ball, right? But it is, I started kicking a football when I was a sophomore in high school. And obviously I was, you know, had accolades of being a all-state player or whatever in soccer. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a great kicker. You know, yes, there's a lot of kickers that come from soccer backgrounds, but there's a lot of hours that get put into technique, contact on a football. It's a completely different swing, per se. In my opinion, you know, somebody like Aubrey is changing the game because it's allowing these soccer players to have the thought of, oh, I could be a kicker, but there's still plenty of hours you have to put in. I don't necessarily believe that you can go – pick somebody off the soccer team that can kick immediately. It took me probably 3.5 years before I was confident enough to go kick in college.
Right. And Aubrey, it was 3 years working with a specialist before he actually started kicking in the USFL. So
correct.
Yeah. Tyler, go ahead.
Mitch, you mentioned the pressure of the extra point against Penn State. And Noah Burnett missed an extra point the other day in a game and got pulled out of a game. I'm curious, why does an extra point bring such pressure? I think folks would assume it's like, well, that's sort of the given. You should always make an extra point. Why does the pressure build in situations like that when folks assume that would be automatic?
Let me ask you guys this. Do either of you play golf?
I don't.
I'm terrible at golf.
Okay. Have you ever watched the golf tournament?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think that the more pressure putts are the 4-footers or the 20-footers?
Yeah,
probably
that.
The 4-footers, right? Because you're expected to make it.
So yeah, it should be a given, right? So, you know, so some of the guys, there is pressure because every kick is not. You know, it doesn't always have to be 50 yards to make it pressure. It's every kick's the same of my snap, my hold, my kick have to be the same process. We have to be in like a connection, like a unit together, because if one minor thing goes wrong, if you know, there's probably a dime size area on a football that you're trying to hit. And if you miss that by a quarter inch, it could be the difference of making and missing the kick.
And how about like holders and snappers and so forth, do you get to like pick out your holder, or do they say, hey, here's your guy? Because I know 1 year with Notre Dame, it was 2014, they had an issue with the holder and they had to switch late in the season. How does that whole process work out?
Usually you're able to kind of work with your snapper and holder. You know, sometimes you're in a pool of guys that have done it before, or, you know, if there was a previous year's holder that did it before, he kind of continues to do it. So But usually the kicker gets the choice of, you know, this is the guy I like to work with. We've worked together all summer, and you kind of get in that rhythm. But sometimes it's still a coaching decision. Like, they're going to put the best guys on the field to help Notre Dame succeed. So, yes. Yes and no, I would say.
Mitch, I'm curious how it impacts a kicker when guys are being – I guess rotated through, like in Saturday's game at Boston College, Noah misses an extra point. He gets pulled. Eric Schmidt goes out to attempt a field goal. He gets pulled. Then Marcello gets asked to kick an extra point. How does that impact a kicker? Does that make the mental process harder when maybe you feel like if you don't make this kick, you might not be sent out to do the next one?
You know, I never was really in that position of rotating kickers. Maybe at South Carolina there was some time when I was kicking off that potentially could have some rotation there. And sure, like you don't want to mess up. But, you know, I think, like I said, the coaches are trying to put the best product for Notre Dame out on the field. And, you know, that they're going to make the right decisions to do that. And if that's a health-related kind of decision, or if that's a performance related decision, I'm not very sure. But you know, I wouldn't think that if you're on the field, you know, as a player, you know, you're trying to do your best all the time. I'm not necessarily worried about if I don't make this play, I'm not going to play, right? Like that, I don't think that's a thought.
I'm curious too, in going from the high school to college transition. I was talking to Marty Biaggi a couple of weeks ago, and he said that is a really big mental hurdle for most kickers. Yep. You know, I look at your resume, and you kicked a 57 yarder in high school, and you were 8 of 10, so you made almost every field goal. I know that you guys had a really good kicker at South Carolina when you got there, and you didn't get to do the place kicking, I think, until your junior year. But would you have been ready as a freshman, and what would have been the biggest hurdle in going from kicking high school and kicking in college, like Eric Schmidt would have to do?
You know, personally, I didn't think, you know, sure, as a freshman, you come in, you're like big eyes, you want to play, right? Like, and I think I was, because I got to kick off, and that was probably the best thing for me, is I got to play and kind of get the nerves out, if you will. In my opinion, you know, in my own experience, as I got older in college, you know, I could look in a crowd and I could pick out people as a young person. Oh, there's my parents, there's my friends. Like, I can see all these different people, right? But as I got older, it all becomes one color. So I'm looking up through the uprights and all I see is garnet black or green, wherever it is. Wherever I'm playing, as I get older, like you don't notice people in the stands. You notice, oh, they're all, you know, it's a glob of blue back there that I'm kicking at, right? Like, so to make the transition from high school to college, it is a you know, a definitely a big jump, because you're in high school. I don't know many people that play in front of 100,000 people, let alone 10,000, unless you're at a big school in Texas, right? Like, you know, so that's definitely a hurdle to get over. But I wouldn't think that would be, you know, you play in probably 4 to 5 games, and that hurdle is usually over.
Mitch, you've mentioned golf a couple times, and mm-hmm. You're certainly not the first to compare kicking to golf in some way. Are you an avid golfer? And is there value to, obviously it's not the same action, but the repetitiveness of golf and sort of the individual pressure on yourself that equates to kicking in some way?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up playing a lot. You know, all my buddies that I grew up with played in college for golf. So they obviously were very successful at a young age, and I was kind of just there being with the guys. But yes, it is a, you know, very similar sport, in my opinion, of you're by yourself. You're having to mentally grind through something, whether that's a swing change or that's a form driven change. And you know, being able to compare the two, it's countless hours of fighting your own mind. And that's the same thing with kicking, of, you know, you're trying to make a gain. and you're working countless hours to do that. So I compare the two. I think, you know, a lot of kickers play golf, or a lot of specialists do, or have played before. And a lot of guys find comfort in it because it's what they do on the field as well.
Mitch, take us through what happened after your eligibility was over at Notre Dame, what that spring was like, spring, summer for you, and then what you're doing now in terms of both football and non-football.
Yeah, so I was in a master's program at the University of Notre Dame in the Mendoza College of Business. I got my master's in business analytics this past May. So I was in South Bend from whenever the national championship was over, January 20th, until about May. I was in and out of South Bend a little bit, obviously doing school, coming home to train with my kicking coach a little bit, and ultimately trying to prepare for pro day. That was the biggest thing for me because I still had aspirations to try to get a shot with the NFL team. And, you know, I was able to do pro day, get my master's, and I got a rookie mini camp invitation with the Minnesota Vikings in May. So I was able to go out to the Minnesota Vikings training facility and be there about 3 to 4 days, basically going through practice with Kevin O'Connell and their whole staff. It was really, really cool, a great experience. You know, all their draft picks and guys like myself that tried to go in there and have a chip on their shoulder to ultimately try to get signed. You know, I felt like I did really well at that camp. I thought I had a really good performance, you know, and thought I was going to leave there with a contract. Ultimately didn't happen that way. And, you know, was fighting to try to get into a training camp a little bit. And, you know, now still keeping that NFL door open, trying to get a shot, still training actively and, you know, trying to have a team call me. But outside of football, I'm kind of looking to get into the business world. I've been doing a lot of interviews with some banks in New York City and some other places around, trying to get my foot in the door with the financial industry.
Mitch, it seems like particularly with kicking in the NFL, like it can sort of happen unexpectedly. You might not know when your next opportunity could come. Like, how do you balance like keeping that a possibility still and maybe feeling like you need to move on with your life? What's the difficulty of balancing those two things?
Yeah, I mean, there's pros and cons to it, right? Like, there's a lot of guys out there that have played in games before that, you know, could be called back into the NFL. You're seeing that now with some kickers getting injured or, you know, illness or, you know, minor injuries. That kind of allows guys to get back in the door if they were in the league and maybe played 4 or 5 games and got caught. And, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that can do this job. And there's 32 jobs in the entire world for everybody trying to fight for it. So being able to, you know, kind of keep the door open and know that your name can be called at any time is pretty important. And something that I'm still working with.
Well, Mitch, I need to tell you, there's a guy that asks questions in our podcast. We have a question section every week, but his is a comment to you. He's from Pennsylvania and he just wanted to thank you for making the field goal against Penn State. I think it changed his life in certain ways. And so I pass it along to you.
Well, it definitely changed mine too. you know, obviously that's a great moment and a moment that I'll have forever. You know, I've got some really cool pictures, really cool mementos from that game. And, you know, it's very special to be able to kind of put your name into Notre Dame history like that. But excited for the guys this year to, you know, hopefully finish the season strong and be able to make another run in a national championship.
Well, awesome, Mitch. We really appreciate you taking time to talk to us today. And best of luck with your ventures.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys, and go Irish.
Before we get back to the podcast, I wanted to share a word from our friends at Academy Sports and Outdoors. The most festive gear of the year is back at Academy Sports and Outdoors. Don't miss the limited edition Magellan Outdoor Christmas Market Collection, only at Academy. Get exclusive 2025 gear and gifts for all your holiday parties, fun family photos, and Christmas morning traditions. Check out the entire collection, from matching PJs and holiday print fishing shirts and dresses to exclusive new Mossy Oak Snowdrift camo styles and more. Shop in-store or at academy.com. Need it fast? Get same-day delivery powered by DoorDash. Let your holiday fun begin with the Magellan Outdoors Christmas Market Collection, only at Academy. All right, now it's time for questions. You can submit questions to us on Twitter or the Loose Emoji Board before every podcast. I'm at TJamesND and Eric's at EHansenND. First one I have for us is a bit of a long one from LDL Go Irish on the Loose Emoji Board. If Notre Dame makes the playoffs, which of these will hurt their chances of advancing the most? Number one, injuries. Those on the injury list not healing by playoff time or new injuries. Number two, depth. Not having more players ready to play should there be an injury. If Jeremiah Love gets a nagging injury like last year, or if Jadarian Price keeps fumbling, the staff has no one ready to go since they are not playing anyone else. Number three, run blocking. Run blocking regressed last week. In my opinion, when teams move and do not play straight up, our line has a difficult time adjusting their blocks either due to recognition or bad footwork. Who calls the blocks on running plays? Number four, young quarterback. There will be new wrinkles thrown at this young but talented quarterback in the playoffs that he will struggle with for a short time in a game. And number five, in-game adjustments, especially in the first half. I was being sarcastic when I suggested weeks ago that Andy coaches had a hard time with the tablets on the sideline, but Notre Dame is ranked 27th, 112th, 17th, and 6th in the country, giving up points first, second, third, and fourth quarters, and is now too many games to be a statistical anomaly.
Well, I say hire this guy to be the statistician. He's got all the great stats. In the order I would put them in, from most likely to hurt to least likely to hurt, I went with injuries one. Run blocking is number two for me. Number three would be the in-game adjustments. Number four would be depth, and number five would be a young quarterback, because I don't think he plays like a young quarterback. He's fourth in the country in pass efficiency and has shown a lot of poise.
Yeah, kicking was conspicuously missing from this list. I would put that ahead of any of these things. The other concerns I have are short yardage offense and defense. I guess short yardage offense would be equated to run blocking. But of those five mentioned, I thought injuries is probably the most impactful, depending on what you get back in terms of when is Billy Stroud available, when is Gabriel Rubio available. Those are big things that could
– and possible new injuries he even brought up.
Sure. All right, next question from at SteveWolf44. Why doesn't Marcus Freeman have tryouts from the soccer team for a kicker?
That's one of the reasons I asked that to Mitch Jeter. First of all, even if there was the next Brandon Aubrey and he had been working behind the scenes for 7 years on this and this was his dream, you can't add them to the roster. With the new roster limits being at 105, once school starts, those 105 are set. Now Notre Dame is over that, because they were able to grandfather in previous players, but you can't add new players. But let's say you could. What a lot of people don't realize about Brandon Aubrey's story is that he hadn't played football since middle school, and he was a really valuable player on the soccer team. When he was a freshman, he played in a national championship game and helped Notre Dame win a national championship. And his dream was to play professional soccer, and he was drafted in the first round. I think one of the things that helped translate his skill set is he was a penalty kick guy, and he was an elite guy at doing that. But, I mean, he went and played professional soccer. Then he was a software engineer. One day his wife kind of suggested, hey, that's kind of the similar motion to a penalty kick. He worked 3 years with a specialist before they felt confident in him having a tryout with a USFL team. So it's not like somebody could just run over from the soccer team, even as Mitch Jeter suggested, and be able to help you this year. I mean, maybe in time. And David Ruffer was a guy back around the Charlie Weiss era, and he spilled over into the Brian Kelly years as well. But Charlie plucked him off of an inner hall team. But that first year, he only kicked an extra point. It really took him a year to be ready to kick in a college game. So that's why they don't add a soccer player.
Yeah, and they have three kickers who they thought were capable of doing this, and I think they still think are capable of doing this. So I'm not sure that, like, bringing someone in who's even less experienced would be the solution, even if that were a possible one. Charles W. Wolf says, is Burnett hurt, inaccurate, or both? Also, as a, and this is the message you passed on to Mitch Jeter, also as an ND fan living in Pennsylvania, please let Mitch Jeter know that I am forever indebted to him.
Charles, I hope I did you justice on the thank you there. Burnett, I think, again, what Mitch Jeter, one of the reasons we asked the questions that we did was to give you some insight into possibly Burnett's situation. He's been intermittently hurt, and striking the ball really puts a lot of stress on the groin and the hip and so forth, and that's what he's dealing with. Is he 100%? I'm not convinced that he is 100% physically. When I had a chance to talk to Marty Biaggi going into the USC game, they were hoping that he would reach that place by the bye week. But whether he's hurt or not, he has some mental hurdles to overcome. And the great thing about it is Notre Dame does have, they do have a plan in place for that. They also have, as Mitch pointed out, they have a sports psychologist that talks to the specialists all the time. So it's not like they're meeting him for the first time when there's problems. They walk through this stuff. And so that would be my best answer to you, other than passing along your message to Mitch.
Yeah, I mean, my best guess is that he was hurt and now he's inaccurate, and the injury may be impacting that. But I'm not sure that we'll get a fully straight answer. Like, I interviewed Mitch Jeter before the Sugar Bowl down in New Orleans, and he certainly didn't describe his injury in terms of his leg being black and blue in the same detail back then.
And bleeding.
Like the details that he's willing to tell us now, a year later, are probably paint a better picture of what he was going through last season. And so I don't know if and when we'll get that information about Noah Burnett in terms of what he's been going through and how much it's still impacting him. All right, next question is from Marie Buff. With regards to the kicking game, I understand Burnett may be injured, but Notre Dame seems to have done the right thing by getting a portal kicker and a high school kicker, as well as others on the roster. Yet the kicking game is not working out. Is there an evaluation issue?
I don't think so. I think Marty Biaggi knows what he's looking for. I think Spencer Schrader is a real good example of that, of a guy that when you look at his resume from South Florida, you just kind of say, really? That's the guy that I actually think that was the previous special teams coach Mason that scouted him. But Marty saw something in him in terms of being able to add distance to his kicks. And that certainly played out. You can't predict injuries. Burnett had a little bit of an injury history his last year at North Carolina, but he also had a history of being really, really reliable for North Carolina. And with Eric Schmidt, you know, that Coles kicking camp, even though it feels like every bio from every kid that goes there is the same, he was ranked as the number one kicker. And those guys get to know, I mean, that whole operation is so well known and so forth. I think they've done a good job of evaluating.
Yeah, and Schmidt, I'm not sure it mattered who you asked. I think most people considered him at least a top five kicker. Like, it wasn't just one site that thought he was greater than the other or one person who thought he was great. So I don't, Notre Dame didn't exactly go out on a limb on recruiting Eric Schmidt. Could you argue that Burnett wasn't the right choice? I think you could, but obviously you got to know what other options are available in terms of willingness to come to Notre Dame. I would be curious to know, like, how much did Notre Dame know about the extent of the injury issues that Noah Burnett had dealt with at North Carolina, and if that would have influenced their opinion or not in terms of what they what they wanted to do with him. At Notre Dame 34 says, do you think the kicking issues were the snap, the hold, or the kick? How would you go about solving them?
Well, for the Texas A&M game, it was the hold. But I would say it was in the Boston College game, it's been the kick. And the hold can be tricky. And I think Mitch Jeter settled on Chris Salerno last year, and that wasn't initially the holder that was going into the summer who he was initially working with in the spring. So they changed holders. Certainly in 2014, there was a huge problem with the holder, and it ended up being Malik Zaire at the end of the year and into the bowl game. But in this operation, it doesn't seem like that's an issue. It really does truly feel like, and you can watch them, and it doesn't feel like those other problems are operational, like the snap's too slow or the holder's moving the ball around or anything like that.
Yeah. We have no indication that it's anything other than the kick. In terms of solving it, my belief is sticking with one guy. Let Noah Burnett work through his issues on the field, unless he's physically incapable of doing that. And if that's the case, let Eric Schmidt take over and just keep him out there and let him work through his inexperience. All right, next question is from Marie Biafore at Biafore underscore Marie. How much of the lackluster performance from the Boston College game do you put on the coaches? Not only was the team flat, but also what did you think about Notre Dame's scouting of Boston College and the game plan that was called? Can you grade the offensive and defensive game plans?
Well, I mean, ultimately, it's the coach's responsibility to have your team ready to play and play well. And, you know, there are aspects that they did play well in, and there's aspects that they didn't. As far as the offensive and defensive game plans, what they did when Lonergan was in there, Dylan Lonergan, is exactly how I would have played Boston College. I would have really focused on stopping the run and putting Boston College in third and longs, and that's exactly what happened. And then they brought in Grayson James, who was more mobile, who was able to be involved in the quarterback running game. And I thought Notre Dame eventually adjusted to that and did a really good job against him in the second half. I think their biggest problems were penalties when it was going to be third and long or fourth and long or getting off the field. There was a penalty that extended drives and let Boston College have the ball. But ultimately, Boston College scored 10 points and had 12 rushing yards. For the offensive game plan, I thought, again, that Notre Dame took pretty good advantage of the fact that Boston College was selling out against the run. Maybe Notre Dame could have made that hurt a little bit more than they did. I would dock them for the short yardage plays. That was a problem. They just weren't as productive as they needed to be. But I guess I'm not giving these letter grades, but that's kind of how I see it. You know, that's what I'm more comfortable doing and rather than a letter grade.
Yeah, I didn't have major issues with either game plan. So I would give both of them Bs. I thought offensively throwing deep worked. It obviously doesn't work every time you try to do it. Certainly would have liked to have a little bit better plan of attack in terms of executing the run game. The defense was creating havoc and plays, but made dumb mistakes and gave up too many conversions. I don't know that a lot of those issues were game plan based. I think that was more execution based. Ultimately, the coaches have to get them ready to play, like Eric said. So I think a lot of the performance you put on the coaches in terms of if you feel like they weren't ready to play or in a position to execute to their best or playing with the right amount of intensity. But in terms of the plan, the game plan itself, I didn't have major issues. All right. Next question is from Baba Ganoush at PLACT underscore ITFDB. Even the worst defense in the nation has been able to stop Notre Dame's run when they load the box and make that a priority. Is it wise to say that every team going forward will do the same? Will Mike Dembrock use pass to set up the run and allow CJ Carr to audible when defenses back off the line of scrimmage?
Okay, there's a lot packed into that. What the teams that remain on the schedule could see is defenses that are constructed a lot like them try the opposite approaches. USC was a really good run defense and not a very good pass defense, and they decided to lean into protecting their pass defense and playing a very light, sometimes a six-man box, which allowed Notre Dame to run crazy. Boston College went the opposite. They're not really good at either, but their worst suit is their pass defense. They leaned into selling against the run and saying, let's hope there's gusty winds. Let's hope CJ Carr has an off day, that he can't be consistent enough to beat us deep. And I think these teams would have probably leaned into the Boston College approach anyways, especially Pittsburgh, because that's kind of their thing. They sell out against the run, they have a lot of blitzes, and they take their chances in the passing game. They may have gotten some ideas from Boston College, but I mean, Pitt's a much better defense than Boston College is. But I could see Navy saying, okay, here's some things that we can learn from that film. And yet you have to be, if you're those teams, you have to adjust to what Mike Denbrock's going to do. Now, what was the part about it? Will Denbrock use the pass to set up the run and allow Carr to audible when the defensive backs? I mean, CJ Carr has that power, has had that power pretty much since the beginning of the season, and he's gotten better at that. That's one of the things that separates him from a lot of redshirt freshman quarterbacks, is how well he can play chess at the line of scrimmage. So having his passing ability and his ability to read defenses and coverages and so forth at the line of scrimmage is a big asset. But I mean, it's never just we're going to do this and we're not varying from this during the game. I mean, it's about trying to strike a balance with your offense, and it's about, adjusting during the game.
Yeah, and I thought Notre Dame tried to set up the run with its passing game against Boston College. The first four plays of the game were pass plays. I think most of the plays in the second drive were pass plays. The end result wasn't what Notre Dame wanted. Don't score touchdowns on those drives or even get field goals. But that, I think, it sometimes it's harder to execute the passing game. Like there's more moving pieces involved in terms of trying to complete a pass, and obviously, I think the wind was a little bit of a factor there that maybe CJ Carr had to adjust to and figure out how that was impacting the passing game. So I think we're going to see similar attempts from defenses, and I think Notre Dame will continue to try to throw over the top when given those opportunities. Baba Ganoush, with another question: in light of Notre Dame's short yardage woes and Price's fumbling issues, is it time to put Aeneas Williams into short yardage situations?
I think as a coaching staff, you have those kind of discussions, whether he's fumbling or not, and given that there's been three of those, I'm not sure that Aeneas Williams is the guy in that situation. It could be Nolan James Jr. That was who they were talking about having in that role back in August. But here's what I think as far as Price. And I saw this with Jonas Gray during his career, and he was eventually able to get over it and became an incredibly valuable player on their team once he did get over it. And when you look at Jadarian Price, there are so many things, positive things he brings to the game that I think that you try to work through it with him and get him in a good place, because we had Dave Brugler on the podcast a couple of podcasts ago, the NFL draft analyst for The Athletic, and he talked about, if he was on another team, he might even be in the Heisman Trophy discussion. I think he's that talented, and I think I would work on that pathway, but I would still have the discussions. Hey, do we have a better short yardage option than either Jeremiah Love or Jadarian Price?
Yeah, that was something I was advocating for, considering I think it was in our post-game takeaways video on Saturday night that, listen, if these fumbling issues are specific to short yardage situations, that maybe someone else needs to be in there and given opportunities, whether it's Aeneas Williams or Nolan James. I think it's worth considering. I don't know what Notre Dame is there isn't seeing from those guys in practices that have prevented them from getting other opportunities. I understand, like, listen, Jeremiah Love and Jarian Pratts are your two best running backs, and so if you feel confident in their ability to execute in those situations, then those are the two guys you're going to be playing. But it hasn't they haven't executed at a high enough rate for you to sort of eliminate consideration for other options. Bob Oxnard on the Loose Emoji Board says, do you think Devontae Smith has the speed, quickness, and lateral agility to effectively cover good receivers?
I mean, his tape would say yes. And he also brings physicality in the nickel, which is what you want. Otherwise, teams can take advantage of you with a physical slot receiver or in the running game. We just haven't seen enough of him this year at Notre Dame to... I mean, the times that he's been healthy and playing, he kind of looks pretty good to me. That just hasn't been the case. But the coaching staff has a lot of confidence in him. And as he works his way back into full health, I think we'll get that answer.
Yeah, I think he does. I'm not certain that he's playing with all those things right now in terms of coming back from an injury. I think it's hard to judge. In that first game back, and I think he gave up 3 receptions on the 3 targets thrown his way, but I do think he brings a valuable asset to Notre Dame's defense, and I'll be interested in monitoring how he continues to progress now that he's healthy and hopefully can stay healthy for the rest of the season. Next question is from Michael John at John Dow, bunch of numbers. If Notre Dame wins, who leads the team in tackles and tackles for loss?
You know, when you look, and Notre Dame's not going to do the exact same thing schematically that they did last year. I'm sure that they're going to have some variations. Jalen Snead was tied with Jack Kaiser for the most tackles. Adon Shuler was up there too. Kaiser, as I mentioned, is not on the team anymore. So I'm going to go with Snead for my tackles guy because I think he'll be all over the place and his speed will play well in this game. Then I thought about tackles for loss. They only had a couple in last year's game. And it could be somebody like Tay Johnson, who's just really good with lateral movement. But I'm going to go with Jared Dawson. Jared has been pretty good in penetration situations. I could see him making some tackles behind the line of scrimmage with the run game. So Dawson is my guy there.
I went with Snead for tackles for losses. I think there's an opportunity for him to make plays there, and I do think he will be involved a lot. I went with Adon Shuler in tackles as someone who's had experience against the option and maybe gets him a couple more opportunities with passing situations to make tackles. I think you could probably pick any one of the linebackers that will play that could very well lead Notre Dame in tackles. So the answer isn't like this person has to lead Notre Dame in tackles for them to win. Like I think there's a number of different options that could play major roles and lead the team in tackles. All right, our last question is from Marie Biafore. Eric and Tyler, you now have each been made the head coach of Notre Dame on separate occasions. What are you going to do about all the undisciplined penalties?
Well, if I'm the head coach, I'm going out and buying a new car with my bigger paycheck. I would say... I mean, you're not going to send them to their room without supper. I think the best thing is, I mean, you want to get this corrected. You don't want to punish them. I'd go over the film, have them watch it, have them see what that looked like, and then talk to them about the mantra that nobody and nothing is worth 15 yards and, you know, get them to play smarter. And if it comes up in practice, you correct it when it happens in practice. You know, Jordan Botello used to be the late hit king in practice and in games when he was a younger player. He got over that. So I think that's the best way to handle it.
Well, in the alternate timeline where I'm the Notre Dame head coach, we would never have undisciplined penalties. So I don't know what I would need to do to fix them. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I think give less playing time to repeat offenders. Like take make sure they're serious. And I think part of the issue is it isn't like there's one or two guys that are constantly making all the issues. It's been a bit widespread for some things. I think the celebrations thing, like I think some of that falls on Notre Dame. If there's knowledge out there that a nose wipe celebration is outlawed in the NFL, like I think someone needs to be aware of that at Notre Dame and make sure their players aren't doing that during games. So they need to have some sort of conversations about what the proper celebrations are moving forward. Cause those are the ones that are the most maddening in my opinion. Those and like late hits. Sometimes it's like you're just being aggressive and it's football. And so sometimes that happens, but you gotta be smart, especially knowing the situation of the game.
And if you do have a runny nose, take Benadryl before the game.
All right. That is it for this week's episode of the Third and Gold podcast. You can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other podcast homes. Search for Notre Dame Football with Eric Hansen and Tyler James. If you're not already subscribed to us on the proper feeds, we will have plenty of written content over at blueandgold.com to get you ready for the Navy game. So stick with Blue and Gold for all your Notre Dame coverage needs.